Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, as well as its impact on our society. And first of all, in the first half of Exploration, we're going to answer some listener phone calls that keep coming in. So once again, in the first half of Exploration, we're going to answer your questions on exploration. And let me just summarize some of the big news of the past few weeks. Space has been dominating the news. We had the spectacular Pluto flyby, a tremendous feat of engineering. Think about it. Launching a space probe that takes years to go to the outer reaches of the solar system, and then fly by Pluto. In fact, having snapshots of the moons of Pluto, five of them, in fact, creating a mini solar system around Pluto. And then you may say to yourself, well, so what? I mean, so we find pictures of a glorious piece of rock in outer space, but what's in it for numero uno? So we'll say a few things about what the space program means for us. And also, just a few days ago, we had that tremendous setback in the space program where we had not one, not two, but three failures to reach the space station, and also three failures to harness a reusable rocket that could have been a game changer. And then we'll also say a few things about robots. If you've been going to the movies, you know that Arnold Schwarzenegger and company have been dominating the movies with Terminator-style robots. And so we'll talk about how far we are with regards to harnessing artificial intelligence. Well, let's just jump right into some of the big stories, the biggest story being outer space. We had those glorious photographs of Pluto. In fact, it's the last celestial body in our neighborhood to be visited by the space program. And Pluto, in some sense, is very important because it's a remnant of the early solar system. The solar system that we see today is not the solar system that it was 4.5 billion years ago. And if you want proof of that, simply look at the moon. The moon is pockmarked by gigantic meteor craters that are remnants of the bombardment of the solar system that took place in its early years. The solar system is about 4.5 billion years ago. And the moon, by the way, is about 4 billion years old. In fact, the moon came out of the Earth. We know this because we have moon rocks that our astronauts took at the end of the Apollo space program. And by analyzing the space rock, we realize that it's very similar in composition to rocks on the planet Earth. While most meteors and comets have a composition totally different from that of the Earth. And so it's believed that about 4.1 billion years ago, an object about the size of Mars plowed into the Earth and blew out debris, which eventually became the moon. So the solar system that we see today is very unlike the solar system as it was 4 billion years ago. However, we have remnants of the early solar system, among them Pluto. Out beyond the orbit of Neptune, we have what is called the comet belt of comets, the Kuiper belt. And the Kuiper belt has been pretty much unchanged for billions and billions of years. And so by analyzing Pluto, we in some sense get a snapshot of the solar system as it was billions of years ago. And as I mentioned, we had a setback in the space program recently. We had not one, two, or three failures to reach the International Space Station. The last failure had 4,000 pounds of food and other supplies that never made it to the International Space Station. But even more important, that third explosion of the SpaceX rocket was important because it was supposed to be a reusable rocket. It costs about $10,000 to put a pound of anything in near-Earth orbit. That's your weight in gold. And that's simply too expensive for the commercialization of outer space. However, if you have a reusable rocket, then it's possible that one day we may drive down the cost by a factor of 2 to 5. However, well, the third try's a charm, but 3 strikes and you're out. The third try failed to harness the power of a reusable rocket. Now, this is also important for President Barack Obama. President Obama canceled the space shuttle. He canceled the Moon program, he canceled the Mars program, and he canceled the replacement for the space shuttle called the Constellation program. So he pretty much canceled the manned space program, and in its place was to be the commercialization of outer space. That's where SpaceX and the different kinds of competitors that are now entering the field come into play. They are going to take over the space program. That is, commercial interest, rather than having taxpayers fund the program, will hopefully drive the future of the space program. And then you may say to yourself, well, so what? I mean, what's in it for numero uno? Well, let me tell you a little story. Back in the early days of the space station, NASA sent into outer space the Tyro satellite, the weather satellite, the first weather satellite to orbit the planet Earth. And many people said, well, what a waste of money. I mean, if you want to know the weather, just go outside, lick your finger, and boom, you know what the weather's like. So why do we need an expensive Tyro space satellite? And for that matter, why do we need a space program at all? Well, around the same time that the Tyro satellite was launched into orbit, it photographed a gigantic hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico about to plow into Texas. So I still remember that very night, LBJ comes on the airwaves and says that today the space program has paid for itself. For the first time in human history, we have photographed a hurricane from outer space, and we know the trajectory of the hurricane. We can then alert the people there to begin evacuation, and we can save thousands of lives and millions of dollars in damages. Well, LBJ was right. Yes, the space program paid for itself, and many times over. Because if you're listening to sound of my voice, chances are some of it was routed through outer space. The telecommunications industry, the GPS system, the internet, a lot of it is routed through outer space. So without the space program, not just having weather satellites, but the telecommunications industry is based in outer space. Now, that doesn't mean that the manned space program pays for itself. Many scientists have said that most of the science that we learn from the space program comes from robots, robotic probes, rather than the manned space program. In fact, if you think about it, the International Space Station, which costs over $100 billion, has yielded very little science. And so we have to realize that a lot of it is, well, to be frank, propaganda. Because we really don't need the International Space Station to get tremendous information about the solar system and about science. And in fact, in the coming years, watch for it, the International Space Station may be deorbited because it has begun to exhaust its lifespan in outer space. And there are very few plans to replace the International Space Station because it is so expensive and we get so little science from it. And then the last question is, besides commercial interests like weather satellites, telecommunications, the internet, and GPS, what about the long-term implications of the space program? Well, let's be very blunt. The dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why the dinosaurs are not here to talk about it. And that's why we are, because we have a chance to avert a catastrophic impact from outer space. In other words, outer space is potentially dangerous. There are meteors, there are comets there in outer space, and we saw evidence of this just 2 years ago when an object about the size of an apartment building slammed into Russia, breaking up over Chelyabinsk, causing massive injuries and shattering scores of windows. And in fact, in 1908, we had an even bigger explosion. An object that had the power of about 1,000 Hiroshima bombs plowed into Tunguska in Russia in 1908. A reminder that, yes, there are rocks in outer space that could destroy civilization as we know it. And in fact, 65 million years ago, an object about 6 miles across plowed into the Yucatan of Mexico and, we think, wiped out the dinosaurs. It created a tremendous cloud of debris, which blanketed the atmosphere of the Earth, plunging temperatures on the planet Earth. There was also a gigantic tsunami that inundated huge parts of North America as a consequence. Forest fires were ignited all over the entire planet as small meteors from the impact began to rain down on the planet Earth. So a combination of meteors, a combination of forest fires, tsunami, and of course nuclear winter, we think, wiped out the dinosaurs. Now, are we next? We have a city buster that hits the Earth perhaps once every century or so, and we had two of them separated by about 100 years that plowed into Russia. Most of these city busters wind up in the oceans, and we're not really aware of them. However, now we do have a space program, and we are beginning to become very much aware of the fact there's a lot of debris out there in outer space. Then we have the potential of a nation buster. That is an object perhaps half a mile, a mile across, that could wipe out not just London, but all of England or huge chunks of Germany. So we have the possibility of a nation buster hitting the planet Earth perhaps once every several hundred thousand years. And then we have the planet buster. That is an object big enough, perhaps 6 miles across or more, capable of knocking out life as we know it. And so we begin to realize that life is very fragile, and we do have to have some early warning system, some way of deflecting these objects before they hit the planet Earth. This is not just a Hollywood movie. This is for real. For example, some people say, well, perhaps we can send Bruce Willis into outer space on the space shuttle, and he can blow up these asteroids. Well, not quite. First of all, we have no space shuttle. It's been canceled. Second of all, even the space shuttle does not have the capability of reaching into deep space. The space shuttle simply spins wheels around the planet Earth. It cannot even reach deep space. And blowing up an asteroid is the last thing you want to do, because then you have lots of mini asteroids coming at you. What you want to do is deflect the object. That is, send a shockwave that'll deflect the asteroid without breaking it up. Now, what's important is that in the coming years, there has been some speculation that Congress will fund a space probe that will perhaps land on an asteroid or have a close encounter with an asteroid. That'll give us detailed information about what it would take to not blow up an asteroid, but to nudge it out of the way. For example, take a look at Apophis. Apophis is an asteroid that'll have a close flyby of the planet Earth in 2029. It is about 1,000 feet across, about the size of the Rose Bowl. It will not hit the Earth, but it will be close enough so that you could probably see it with the naked eye or perhaps with binoculars as it whizzes overhead in 2029 and again in 2036. Perhaps that's an opportunity for NASA to send a space probe to land on Apophis, or perhaps take close-up pictures to understand its composition and the best way to deflect an asteroid of that size. Once again, that asteroid is perhaps a nation buster, perhaps an asteroid big enough to take out England if it were to hit the planet Earth. Well, also in the news, we have the whole question about robots. If you've been going to Hollywood movies recently, you know there have been a lot of movies featuring artificial intelligence robots. And of course, well, outside the movie Her, all the robots are mean, ugly, and they want to wipe out humanity. And so the question is, well, how far are we in terms of really harnessing robots? Is it possible that one day they could take over? Well, one day, could they take over? Yes, that's conceivable, but it's not going to happen for a while. Because how smart is our most advanced robots? Well, I had a chance to interview the inventor of Asimo, which is perhaps the smartest robot on the planet Earth. You've probably seen it on television. It's made by the Honda Corporation. It can walk. It can run. It can climb up stairs. It can dance. In fact, it dances much better than me. I've been on several specials with Asimo on TV. And Asimo, the robot, yes, does seem to be very intelligent. So for BBC Television, I interviewed the creator of the Asimo robot, and I asked him, how smart is your robot? And I paraphrase, He said, in all honesty, that his creation, perhaps one of the smartest robots on Earth, has the intelligence of a cockroach, a retarded, lobotomized cockroach. In other words, not very smart. Now, you may say to yourself, well, we have all these Hollywood movies talking about Terminator robots taking over, and you're telling me that our most advanced robots have the intelligence of an insect. And yeah, that's absolutely right. In the coming years, however, we do expect improvements to be made on these robots. In the coming years, we may have a robot as smart as a mouse, and then as smart as a rat, then as smart as a rabbit, then perhaps as smart as a cat, and then a dog, and perhaps late in this century, perhaps a robot as smart as a monkey. At that point, I think they could be potentially dangerous. Monkeys, of course, have an agenda all their own, and so we may have to put a chip in the brain of a mechanical robot to shut them off if they have murderous thoughts. So in other words, yes, it is possible that one day we will have intelligent machines as intelligent as us. Yes, perhaps one day they could be a threat, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. In fact, the director of the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, who we've had on Exploration, in fact, has stated that the chance of a robot walking out of somebody's basement laboratory is about the same as the probability that a hurricane will sweep up debris and create a Boeing 747 jetliner. In other words, it's not going to happen anytime soon. Now, the ideal place to put a robot is at the Fukushima nuclear power station. There we have not one, not two, but three melted nuclear power plants. It may take perhaps 40 years to clean up that mess at Fukushima. And you may say to yourself, well, why? Why is it going to take so long to clean up the mess? And the answer is robots are useless at Fukushima because they're simply too stupid to clean up the mess at the Fukushima reactor. That's why the United States Pentagon has stepped in. DARPA, a branch of the United States Pentagon, funds very futuristic programs. For example, one of the projects of DARPA in the 1950s was to create NASA. That's right, NASA itself is a creation of DARPA. Another creation of DARPA is the Internet. That's right, the Internet was originally a military weapon. It was funded by DARPA and was originally called ARPANET. It was not called the Internet at all. It was called ARPANET after the military agency that was funding it. Look at the GPS program. The GPS program was not created so that hikers can locate themselves or mothers can locate lost children at a supermarket. That's not why the Pentagon spent billions of dollars perfecting the GPS system. It, too, was a military weapon, and it was designed to track rockets as they sailed toward Moscow in World War III. However, now that we do have DARPA, we realize that DARPA has yet funded another program, a DARPA challenge. The last DARPA challenge program, by the way, was to create a driverless car. In fact, one of these days in the near future, you will probably be driving a driverless car, compliments of the United States Pentagon. Well, the latest DARPA challenge is to create a Fukushima robot. That is, a robot that is smart enough to turn a screw, pick up a hammer, use a saw, and use a broom to clean up the mess at Fukushima. Now, you may say to yourself, now, wait a minute. Any idiot can do that. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to pick up a hammer or turn a valve or turn a screwdriver. Well, yes. But robots can't do any of the above. That's right, robots cannot do any of the above. And that's why the Pentagon has given a DARPA prize, millions of dollars, to the organization that can successfully negotiate these challenges, such as picking up a broom and cleaning up the mess, the radioactive mess, at Fukushima. Then you may say to yourself, well, what's the problem? What do we have that robots don't have, and vice versa? Well, you've probably noticed that robots can do things much faster than us. For example, add. Robots can add numbers millions of times faster than us. However, robots do not have simple common sense. They don't understand that water is wet, that mothers are older than their daughters, that when you die, you don't come back the next day, that strings can pull, but strings cannot push. So, what's the problem? Well, for the past 50 years, engineers and scientists have followed what is called the top-down approach. That is, they wanted to put all the laws of logic, all the laws of common sense, into a disk, such that when you put the disk into a computer, the computer suddenly says, I am aware, I am awake, I am alive, I am artificially intelligent. That's a top-down approach, programming everything onto a disk, inserting the disk into a computer, and the computer comes alive. Well, that failed. Failed miserably. How many lines of computer code does it take to have common sense? Well, it turns out hundreds of millions of lines of common sense and code are necessary to reproduce the common sense of a three-year-old child. And so now you begin to realize how difficult things are. Things that we take for granted, like common sense, are very difficult for computers. But things that computers take for granted, like adding huge numbers, well, we cannot perform these operations. And so what is the difference? The difference is our brain is not a computer. Now, that's right. We were misled 50 years ago into thinking that we can build thinking machines, robots, that think like us by the top-down approach. No, our brain is not a computer, a digital computer. Our brain has no programming. Our brain has no Windows. Our brain has no CPU. It has no Pentium chip. It has no subroutines. Our brain is not a digital computer at all. Our brain is a neural network. That is, it's a learning machine of some sort. It learns after performing every task. Your laptop today is just as stupid as it was yesterday. I mean, think about it. Your computers never learn anything. They never get smarter. However, that's what we do. We get smarter every day by learning. Every time we make a mistake, we learn to correct that mistake. And that's what neural networks do. Neural networks rewire themselves after performing every task. That's why a neural network is not the same as it was yesterday. It has rewired itself to learn. And so this is now called the bottom-up approach. That's the approach of Mother Nature. I mean, think about it. Mother Nature, through evolution, has created thinking machines like human beings. But how did Mother Nature do it? Mother Nature did it the hard way, and that is the bottom-up approach. Bumping into things, making mistakes, the school of hard knocks. That's how bugs do it. That's how rabbits do it. And eventually, that's how humans did it. And so, in other words, the way that we became intelligent was through evolution. Evolution gave us thinking machines, i.e. us, because of our long ancestry in which we had machines that were so smart. And so evolution, through trial and error, eventually gave us thinking machines, machines that can think like us. And then the question is, how long will it take before we can get thinking machines like this? Well, I don't know. But I would suspect that perhaps late in this century, we will have machines as smart as us. And then, will they be a threat to us? And the answer is potentially yes. As I mentioned, I think we should put a chip in their brain to shut them off if they have murderous thoughts. Now, you may say to yourself, well, that's at the end of this century. But progress doesn't stop. What's to prevent robots from getting even smarter than us? And then if they're smarter than us, perhaps they can evade a chip placed in their brain. Well, one possibility is to merge with them. That is, why not augment ourselves so we become super intelligent as well? Now, traditionally, that was a science fiction scenario, sounded great, but practically impossible. However, in the last few years, there have been a number of breakthroughs which may make possible the enhancement of the human being. So perhaps merging with our computer creations is not such a far-fetched idea, perhaps in the 22nd century, not in this century, but in the 22nd century. For example, Iron Man is possible. It is now possible to directly hook up the human brain to an exoskeleton, giving us literally superpowers, mentally controlling an exoskeleton that gives us superpowers just like in the comic books. Not only that, but why not connect our brain mentally with a computer such that we can move objects around us? In other words, we will have the power of telekinesis, the power to move objects around us mentally because our brain connects us to our surrounding environment. Now, we do not have this capability yet, but if you read my book, The Future of the Mind, you begin to realize that the basic components of this are already in place. We can now upload simple memories into a brain. We can record simple memories, the memories in animals. This has been done already with mice. It's only a matter of time before we can augment our memory for Alzheimer's patients and perhaps eventually for the average person as well. So augmenting the human capabilities is a possibility perhaps late in this century, i.e. creating Iron Man costumes that give us superpowers, exoskeletons with super capabilities, recording memories, uploading memories, and the power of telekinesis and telepathy. These are all now scientifically possible. Well, that concludes the first half of Exploration. And then in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on our special guest today. He's Professor Greg Stock, professor at UCLA, and he has a rather unusual take on biotechnology. And that is it possible to redesign the human race genetically? I mean, think about this. Is it possible that we can change our genetic heritage almost at will? As you can imagine, this raises all sorts of ethical and moral questions. What happens if we can do more than simply change the color of our hair or perhaps change the color of our eyes with the contact lenses? What happens if we can actually change our genes and redesign the human race? Stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration. Well, that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration as we continue our journey into science, talking about, well, is it possible to redesign the human race? Our special guest once again is Professor Greg Stock of UCLA. And by the way, if you want a copy of today's program, you can call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Stay tuned. Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we read some email, answered some questions about some of the latest movies like The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything, and in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on UCLA Professor Greg Stock. Redesigning the Human Race. How far should we go? With biotechnology today, we can do wonders. We can begin to cure diseases that were unimaginable before. But how far should we go to redesign the genetic heritage of the human race? These are some of the questions we're going to be talking about now in the second half of Exploration. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor Gregory Stock of the University of California at Los Angeles, where he's the director of the Program on Medicine, Technology, and Society. And he's the author of a very controversial book called Redesigning Humans. That's right, Redesigning Humans, Choosing Our Genes, Changing Our Future. In other words, we're not talking about something that's going to happen anytime soon. But perhaps 50 years, perhaps 100 years into the future, who knows for sure, we may have the ability to tinker with our genetic heritage. And then the question is that a good thing? Is it a good thing if every parent can begin to choose the characteristics of their children? What about the future of the human race? What about medicine? What about ethics? These and other questions we're going to be exploring with Dr. Gregory Stock of UCLA, author of the book, Redesigning Humans. Okay, the first question for you, Dr. Stock, is how did you first get interested as a youth in biology and medicine?
Well, I've sort of been interested in the issues of life for as long as I can remember, and I think the epiphany that I had being as a graduate student just about to get my doctorate in molecular biology was that suddenly I was walking on campus and realized that I didn't really know the difference between an oak tree and an elm tree. And I realized I was at too much of a molecular level, so I thought it would be worthwhile for me to step back a little bit and look at more systems biology.
Okay. And why did you specifically get interested in the whole question of genes, genetic modification, and genetic enhancement?
Well, I was developing some ideas related to sort of levels of complexity in life. And that there are multiple very distinct levels of complexity, the lowest being that of bacteria, which is just essentially a little bag of biochemicals and no internal structure or anything. And then animal cells or eukaryotes are a million times the volume. They have all sorts of compartments. They are much, much more complex. And it turns out that the origins of some of those components were, in fact, bacteria themselves, which came together symbiotically and then formed really complex organizational structures. And then this happened again with the formation of multicellular life, all of the complex multicellular organisms, the animals and plants that are filling up the environment that we see, that we can observe around us. And now there's yet another step that is occurring where, led by human activity and our fusion with telecommunication technologies and all sorts of things that are drawing us together as a very integrated sort of a superorganism, the implications of that are really profound for not just human society, which is actually an organism and can be seen very clearly as that if you look into it in detail. And that's the subject of a book I wrote called The Fusion of Humans and Machines into a Global Superorganism. And I was interested in what the biggest implication of that was. And things like space travel and such are some of the products of that collaboration. But the most interesting for us, I think, is the way these technologies will then be turned back upon ourselves and reshape our own biology. And so that's how I really got interested in the sort of genomics and the various ways in which these, you know, extraordinarily precise and powerful technologies were beginning to be to have the possibility of reshaping human life itself.
Okay, and speaking about reshaping human life, some people get a little bit squeamish when they think about that. They remember what happened with the Nazis and eugenics. However, isn't it true that historically, humans have in fact been enhancing other species, like dogs? Haven't we been breeding dogs for thousands of years? And what about plants as well?
Yes, it's definite that there is not, this is not something new. It's just that the tools that are being brought to bear upon biology are so much more sophisticated. So I think that canine breeding is an excellent example, and is actually going to serve as sort of a pilot project for our own self-modification, in that here we're using the most kind of primitive tools of selection and breeding. And look at the diversity that exists in the canine realm. I mean, it's truly extraordinary. And so to think that when we're sort of exerting control over our own reproductive possibilities, essentially through in vitro fertilization, through genetic screening, all of these sorts of things, that there won't be significant implications for us as a species, as individuals, as a culture, as cultures, I think is very much putting one's head in the sand just because of all these previous examples.
Well, let's look at the pros and cons. The pro side would be that dogs are very plentiful and successful in North America, while Canis lupus, the gray wolf, is near extinction in many areas. And so the dog benefited by genetic enhancement being close to humans. But dogs also have lots of genetic defects. Genetic defects because of all the inbreeding that took place over thousands of years. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that there are inbreeding issues, especially with certain breeds. Many dogs have a longer life expectancy, certainly, than the gray wolf in the wild. But yes, there will be consequences of that sort, and especially when you have the kind with sort of crude the kinds of selective tools that one uses and in natural breeding, you're much more likely to get these sorts of issues because you have large clusters of genes that are exchanged, and you have inbreeding problems and such. I would imagine that those will be less significant when this occurs in humans for several reasons. One is that the advances in medical technology are such that they mute some of the problems that might otherwise be significant. For example, the most obvious or a very obvious example of that is eyesight, where virtually everyone over the age of 40 requires glasses, and we wouldn't be very functional without them. And yet we don't even look at it as a disability. And there are a variety of other kinds of what would have been even fatal diseases that no longer are such. And in fact, that has had a huge impact in the spread of various mutations that would otherwise be very, very debilitating, because we survive longer. We reach reproductive age when otherwise we might not have. So I see that as one reason that these are less likely, that they are unlikely to be things that we can't deal with. And another is that we're really understanding human biology and life in general in a much more profound and nuanced way.
And also look at our dinner table. Believe it or not, much of the foods we eat for dinner have been genetically enhanced by humans over thousands of years. But if you look at corn, even though corn was domesticated by Native Americans, corn cannot exist without humans. The kernels don't fall off without human intervention. Therefore, corn is very plentiful, very shiny, very tasteful, but it is totally dependent upon humans for reproduction. Without humans, corn cannot exist. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are several in that. First of all, virtually all of the foods that we eat are the product of human breeding in one way or another. So the idea that there are natural foods is demonstrates an ignorance of the whole process by which all of the grains and staples that we eat or how they evolved. I mean, a potato was a little thing the size of a pea, for example, and the same thing, as you mentioned, with corn. The second is that I agree that we're likely not to be able to survive in an environment that it does not have technology. And in fact, that's already the case, not just because of our biology, but look at our population. We couldn't support the human population without the kinds of high technology, agriculture and such that we have. And so the population is way beyond the level that it could we could live in a subsistence kind of a lifestyle. Many individuals who really give birth to children, and they wouldn't be able to do that outside of a hospital. I mean, you have all sorts of interventions, which those interventions make it more likely that such problems will be more significant, not less, in the future. So I think that we are definitely increasingly adapted to a high-technology, human-centered sort of an environment, and the idea that we're going to go back in some way or would even have the possibility of doing that, I think, is there is no real possibility that that could occur.
Okay, so we talked about the past where everything, including our dinner table, dogs, cats, horses, sheep, all of them have been tinkered with and enhanced to some degree by human intervention. Now let's talk about today. We see science fiction movies where life forms can be manipulated at will. But isn't it true that gene therapy, the simplest example of just fixing a broken gene, that that's really in its infancy? And that there's really only one disease that can be so-called cured using gene therapy, and that's called the Bubble Boy Syndrome, or SCIDS. So aren't we at the beginning of this technology?
Very much at the beginning. I would differ sharply, though, with your assessment that that is the simplest of the sort of interventions that one can think of. It's actually probably the most difficult, and the reason for that is that if you're going to try and do genetic interventions, you have to find a mechanism for putting in place a significant segment of DNA and the control mechanisms to determine when that would be turned off, on and off appropriately, and then get them into individual cells in an already existing body. That's a very, very difficult and challenging process, and an unnatural one in many ways, in the sense that the much easier and simpler way to do that would be to select or alter the genes that are in the first cell of the human embryo, and then they would be copied into every cell in the human body, along with structures that would turn them on and off, orchestrate their activity at the appropriate times and places. And that's kind of the way our genetics works naturally, in that we have every cell in the body has the same genes. It's just that different clusters of them are turned on in, say, bone than in skin or in neural tissue. And so these are the kinds of things that are possible and are much, much simpler than genetic interventions, which I think Jim Watson said that if you waited to do germline intervention, which are those that are to embryos and single cells, that if you waited for somatic engineering, the kinds of genetic interventions that are done today, to be successful, you'd wait until the sun froze over.
Okay, well, if you are Jewish, you have to worry about Tay-Sachs. If you are Caucasian, you have to worry about cystic fibrosis. And in fact, in Brooklyn, there's even a group of Orthodox Jews who get screened. And if the embryos, via implantation, if the embryos carry the bad gene, you can reject them. And in that way, they hope to literally eliminate that gene from that population. So what are some other ways in which people today can actually begin to tinker with the genetics of their children?
Well, you mentioned it right there with actually creating a number of embryos during the process of in vitro fertilization, where you take an egg and a sperm and fertilize them in a petri dish, allow them to come together in a petri dish, and then you wait until they grow up to, say, the 6th or 8th cell stage. You remove one of the cells which isn't damaging to the embryo, and then you run a genetic test on that cell, and depending on the results, you decide whether to use or discard that embryo. That's done to avoid cystic fibrosis, to avoid Tay-Sachs. In fact, in the Jewish community, there are people have genetic tests and use that as to avoid marriages that would likely lead to children with such problems, and that's a common thing as well. So the idea of genetic screening is the easiest way that you could exploit the possibilities of these new technologies, because there you're not actually altering or changing, you're just reading out the genetic code, which is something that we can already do, although we'll be able to do it much more easily and rapidly and in more sophisticated fashions, and then making a decision based on that. So there is no risk involved, essentially, or very, very limited risks involved. And that, I think, is going to be the first application that is widespread, and that will happen relatively quickly.
Okay, now let's look at maybe a 20-year timeline, and then we'll look into the next 100, 200 years, which, of course, borders on science fiction. Mm-hmm. But let's take a look at a 20-year timeline. What kinds of therapies, what kinds of procedures are going to be available within that time frame, a 20-year time frame?
So in a 20-year time frame, I think there will be some sort of niche technologies which gain a lot of publicity today but aren't really very interesting, things like human cloning and such, which I think, even if broadly available, would only be used by very small numbers of people. The kinds of genetic engineering technologies, which I've discussed at length, where you'd actually go in and alter chromosomes and add clusters of genes and such, those almost certainly will not be used other than possibly in animals, and they're already being used a little bit in animals within that time frame. The kinds of things that will be dramatically more sophisticated and will be widely available within a 20-year time frame will be the genetic screening technology that we just discussed. And there, one will be not only screening for genetic diseases, which is already done today for a few genetic diseases, it'll be done much more broadly in a much more nuanced fashion. But I believe that there will be choices being made based on matters of temperament and personality and predispositions that involve risk for certain, for manic depression or other kinds of disorders that, you know, are only on the borderline viewed as diseases. And so there will be basically parents, prospective parents, will be exerting choices over the genetic makeup of their children based on their individual preferences and wants.
Okay, let's talk about that now, because let's look at a 20-plus-year horizon, 20-50-year horizon, let's say, when some of the genes for attractiveness are isolated. There was a blip in the media the other day stating that shoppers spend more time taking care of their attractive children than they do with their unattractive children. And parents, of course, spend thousands of dollars on violin lessons for their children and SAT lessons to enhance their children to get into college to increase their reproductive success. But wouldn't parents therefore be hardwired not just to give violin lessons, but to actually make the children more attractive?
Well, almost certainly to pick certain traits. I think one gets into surprising choices that people would make that some of us would not consider to be enhancement, but would be so in the eyes of the parents. And what I'm referring to is, for example, that deaf parents have already, I've spoken to deaf parents who have said, or interacted with deaf parents who have said that they would use such technology to ensure that their children, not that their children were hearing, but that they were deaf, so that they could fit better into the environment, that they could, into the deaf culture, that they would be able to interact more with them as parents. So the choices that people make are very interesting. Some people would like to enhance one's IQ and intelligence. Another would be interested in aspects of physicality or in appearance. And I think there will be very, very, very diverse choices that are being made. But yes, parents will definitely want to make those choices and, in fact, will make those choices.
And, in fact, if you just found out that the Joneses next door had their kid genetically enhanced and your kid, who is not enhanced, has to compete against the Joneses' kid, Won't you therefore make a beeline to the nearest genetic enhancer so that your kid is competitive against your next-door neighbor's kid?
Yeah, maybe. It's sort of interesting, though, because the difficulty of you applying the technology will be directly proportional to the amount of enhancement that one exerts. So to actually create, for instance, super children in one way or another, no matter what the trait is, will be very complex and very slow in coming, whereas the possibility of improving some vector of performance from below average to average or average to slightly above average will be much, much easier. So there'll tend to be a leveling that will occur when these technologies are applied. I think of it as like giving parents the ability to create a virtual projection of some of the aspects of that would likely be manifested in future children, and then to make choices among those virtual siblings that they would that would be represented by embryos. So, yes, it could create significant enhancements in various dimensions and do it very, very rapidly if, in fact, for example, what we know about the genetic basis for IQ, which is not insignificant at all, certainly probably over 50% from twin studies, identical twins reared together and reared apart, a whole variety of studies in that realm. If you could identify the many genes that are involved in that and make choices based on them, you would, within a single generation, parents would probably increase the IQ of their kids by perhaps 20 points when they, if that was what really interested them. So that's a huge step in a very short period of time. And I think that there would be movement in many, many different directions so that there would sort of be a radiation of human form.
Okay, well, let's take these one at a time because you raise a whole bunch of things. Strength. Just recently, scientists have been studying a gene which makes a mouse muscle-bound. The mouse has tremendous muscles. They call that mouse a mighty mouse in the media. And that gene or a counterpart of that has been found in children now, human children. And the question is, what does it mean to be an Olympic sportsman or sportswoman? What does it mean to be a Yankee home run batter if it's all just a question of genetic enhancement?
Well, I think it's going to be a real interplay of many, many factors, of which genetics will be a very, very important one and a requirement, essentially. That, I mean, if you know relatively early on today whether you have the genes, whether you have the physique that you're going to be competitive at a world-class level, that you even have the hope of being competitive in various sports. And you'd have to combine with that an incredible drive and an environment that nurtured that. I would say that if you had 50 clones of Michael Jordan, that not all of them would be superstars. That there would be other factors that would intervene to avoid those, you know, to interfere with that or to prevent that in one way or another. But, yeah, so what does it mean to be a superstar? Well, today it used to be that there were amateur athletes, and now today for somebody to perform at a world-class status, in a sort of a world-class status, you have to basically be devoted to a sport from a very, very early age and make it your career. And that certainly wasn't the case. So the sense of what it takes to be a professional at a world-class level will just continue to be refined. And I suspect that you may eventually reach the point where it's like having a race car, where, you know, there's a whole team, including physicians and others, that are the support sort of group for any world-class athlete.
Okay, well, we have numerous steroid scandals, and we believe in a meritocracy, that you should work at being a great athlete, not simply take a steroid and hit the ball out of the ballpark. And yet here we're talking about something even greater than steroids, actually literally changing the genetic structure of your muscle and bones, right? So won't that also create a scandal?
Well, I think it will create a change in the way people look at these things, because as it is right now, there are the idea that there is going to be sort of a natural Olympics in some way, or that there are sports where people do not use various aids of one sort or another. You know, that's really, as we've seen in baseball, that's really not the case. And the idea that we're going to be able to enforce those things is very unlikely as well, because the monetary rewards are too significant for success. And so it's just a constant battle between those who are trying to enhance in one way or another through genetic, through drugs, through all sorts of things, and those who are trying to discover those. And actually, there are certain incentives for the sports organizations to see increased performance. It'll be interesting to see what will happen to the perceptions of the game if, in fact, performance settles back and isn't as strong as when, you know, new home run records were being set. So I think that as we move ahead, that it's going to become increasingly accepted that we manipulate our bodies in a variety of ways using interventions. What we will not want to see is ways in which these are dangerous interventions. But I would like to say, what are you going to do if, in fact, there is something that you could take that would increase performance or increase one's memory or increase any aspect of one's functioning and, in fact, is not dangerous, where there are no side effects that are adverse? It's sort of a recreational drug of sorts, but one without the side effects of many of the ones today. Are we ourselves not going to want to take those? I mean, remember, we take things to put ourselves to sleep, to wake ourselves up, to kill pain, to, you know, we intervene in all sorts of ways with legal pharmaceuticals. So the line between what is a pharmaceutical and what is an illicit drug is going to be an increasingly arbitrary one, and those discussions will seem a little bit surreal as we move forward.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, in the first half of Exploration, we answered some questions that I get from email about the latest movies, including The Imitation Game and also The Theory of Everything. And in the second half, we brought on UCLA professor Greg Stock talking about redesigning humans. How can it be done and how far should we go? And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration.